Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to analyzing the major economic events and trends of our lives. What shapes our jobs, our incomes, our taxes, our debts, generally the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I'm a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news and analysis that you can consult on a daily basis, truthout.org. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis we do on this program, please know that we post this kind of material, much more of it than we have time for on this program, on our two websites. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Please go to those websites, take advantage of the materials we put there, and also consider sending us your comments, your questions. Those are used by my staff, myself, to shape this program, and we always pick a couple towards the end to respond to directly. You can send us your comments through either website, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And finally, please remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Economic updates this first week of December 2013 are many, more than we can handle. One of the big explosive items this last week has been the question of pensions for public employees. Basically, the state of Illinois, the city of Detroit, and many other cities, but particularly Illinois and Detroit, have announced plans to cut the pensions of public workers. Pensions that they paid into for many years, pensions that they counted on, pensions that were given to them as part of bargains, collective bargaining bargains, between city administrations and the unions representing public employees. And I want to talk about that. It's hard to talk about that in an even tone, because the moral and ethical dimensions of this process are horrific. Let's begin. Over the years, workers for public jobs around the country did, much like their counterparts in the private sector, make an arrangement with their employer. They said, look, you can help us, Mr. Employer, by withholding a certain amount of money from our paycheck, basically performing a savings function for us, and setting aside the money accumulated in a safe kind of investment, maybe government treasury bonds, something that is not risky. And over the lifetime of our jobs, we will thereby accumulate a safety net, nest egg, you might call it, of savings that can help us in our retirement, that can mean we can live a decent life in the years after we finished working, without being a burden on our children, without being a burden on the community. And the employer said, okay, I'll do that, but that's something I do for you. I want you to do something for me, which the workers generally agreed to. For example, they gave up a wage increase of maybe, say, 5%, accepting instead a wage increase of 3%, with the other 2% not being a payment to them in a wage, but rather money set aside for their future pensions. Imagine then that what the state of Illinois is now doing and what the city of Detroit is planning to do now that the bankruptcy judge has ruled that they can do this is basically renege on that deal. There's no other way to describe this. They're going to not pay a portion of the pensions that workers contracted for, that workers took lower wages to pay for, that city administrations legally entered into contracts to provide. All of that is being changed. At whose expense? Public workers. Older public workers, those that have retired, and current public workers who are going to be losing more or less of the money they put aside and of any opportunity for a decent pension in the future. This is a fundamental assault of city and state governments against public employees. So why is it happening? The main reason, the overwhelmingly main reason, is simple and straightforward. It's the economic crisis that has overwhelmed Western capitalism and the United States' economy in particular. Since 2007, we have millions of more people out of work, not paying income taxes, millions of people with jobs that are less secure, fewer benefits, lower wages. And those people make fewer expenditures, mean less sales tax coming into the government on top of fewer income taxes. You get the picture. Governments everywhere are strapped. Is this because of public employees' pensions? Not at all. Those pensions haven't gone up in any kind of dramatic way in recent years. Quite the contrary. The pensions have been reduced because public employees have been laid off in large numbers. And so the city doesn't have to provide pensions for those people that aren't working for the city or the state government. So what's going on? Cities and states are strapped because they're not getting the usual taxes from an economy suffering unemployment. But instead of going after taxing the corporations who've escaped their fair share for decades, instead of going after those most able to pay, the rich who have gotten so much richer in the last 30 years, no, they're not choosing to solve their problem that way. They're choosing to scapegoat public employee pensions, the money set aside contractually, legally, and morally owed to those people, and take it away from them. Nothing more clearly demonstrates where this society is going than this horrific way of trying to solve a social problem on the backs of those who had nothing to do with bringing this crisis, who have not increased their demands on the cities and the states, but are going to be savaged as part of a society whose economic system no longer works. Second update for today. President Obama gave a speech this last week about inequality. And in that speech, he said that he was concerned about it. And he also spoke about the minimum wage and the need to raise it. This requires me to say a couple of things quickly. First, I'm very glad that President Obama is concerned about inequality. Since the inequality of the United States is now greater than that of any other advanced industrial country, since the inequality in the United States has been getting worse steadily for the last 30 years, one might be tempted to say that President Obama's recognition of this problem is a little late, a little slow. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say better late than never. Let's talk about the minimum wage as the president did. Minimum wage is $7.25. As I've made clear on this program many times, that's the lowest minimum wage of any of the advanced industrial countries. It's less than half the minimum wage in Australia. In Germany this last week, they finally agreed on a minimum wage in that country, 8.5 euros, about $11.75 by current exchange rates. 11.75 in Germany. $7.25 here. A recent survey carried out in the second half of November 2013 by the CBS Corporation found roughly 25% of Americans do not believe the minimum wage should be raised. Interesting group of people, don't you think? 25%. But here's the more interesting number. Over one-third of Americans polled think that the minimum wage should be raised to 9%. And another third believe it should be raised, to $9, and another third to $10 an hour. In other words, a clear majority of Americans, an overwhelming majority, believe that the minimum wage should be higher than it is, just like a majority of Americans think we should have less inequality. You might ask yourself then, in view of the overwhelming support for a higher minimum wage and the overwhelming support for lower inequality, we have a president and a Congress who have been making inequality worse over the last 10 years, 15, 20 years, and are only now recognizing, gee, that might be a problem. Here's an interesting update that you might not have thought of, but that I want to bring to your attention, because it teaches us another lesson. Recent statistics show, and recent announcements show, that there are three countries in the world that are becoming the absolute leaders in international jet travel. They're the ones who are buying and deploying wide-body jets, those enormous airplanes that are doing more and more of the international movement of passengers. What are these three airlines? I'm going to give you the names. Emirates, Etihad Airlines, and Qatar Airways. That's right. Tiny little countries located in the same little corner of the Persian Gulf area are now the leading buyers and users of wide-body aircraft. The Emirates, the largest one, was begun in 1985. Keep in mind that American airline companies, the major ones, have been in business for many decades. Emirates started in 1985 with one jet plane, and they are now the world's biggest air carrier. And here are some statistics for you. These three little countries, all of whom depend on oil, all of whom were created in relationship to the Western countries that wanted to buy the oil and wanted to have small countries that would be dependent on the United States and the West militarily and politically so they could control nicely the flow of oil that they depended on. So much money was made by these three little tiny countries that they had to look around for a way to make money with all the money they were earning on oil. And they decided that international air travel was where they would go. As a result, those three tiny countries operate, get ready now, more wide-bodied airplanes than all American carriers combined. Wow. What is going on here? It's another measure of the decline of the United States in a larger world economy. Here's the irony. It was the United States that helped set up those countries. It's the United States that funds all the oil money that is paid into them. It is the United States that protects them militarily. And it is the United States whose airline business they are taking as a result. Remarkable. And you know who else is helping? Boeing and other big companies, because they want the business of selling airplanes to those people because they're the biggest buyer of wide-body aircraft in the world. There couldn't be a program of the Boeing company to produce its latest jet, the 777X, if it weren't for the orders coming from these three tiny Middle Eastern oil companies and countries. I think it's something to think about. The inequality that this produces, the concentration of wealth in the tiny hands of a small country created by oil that can now dominate a whole other industry. And it's costing the United States, but you can't work it out because the big companies that want to sell airplanes are at loggerheads with the big American airline companies that don't want the competition. They'll fight it out, but meanwhile, the decline of the United States and the inequality being generated by this way of organizing the world economy are obvious for all to see. Next update, a simple and a short one. This has to do with the relationship of unemployed people to job openings. You know, companies interested in hiring people issue announcements. They file vacancy reports. The government collects all this information to determine how many job vacancies, how many job openings are there, and then compares that number with the number of unemployed looking for work. So here's the number of unemployed persons for each job opening. If we go to the beginning of the current crisis, 2007, the number of unemployed people per job opening was around 1.5. 1.5 people for every looking for work for every job available. What is it today, 2013? Have we recovered from this situation where there are more people looking than there are jobs? Answer, not at all. In fact, today, we have 3 people looking for every job opening that's available. In other words, here we are, 6 years into a crisis. Not only have we not improved the ratio of unemployed people to job openings, it's twice as bad as it was when this crisis began. Keep that in mind the next time you hear about recovery. The next update is a stunning story that caught my eye, and I want to talk to you briefly about it because some of you may have come across this already, but I think I have a different take on it. The HBO network on cable television had a documentary last week that they broadcast called Toxic Hot Seat. And this occasioned also a column by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times of November 23rd about that HBO. And I want to tell you the story, but again, in a different way. This has to do with flame retardant chemicals. That's right, chemicals that are put into things supposedly to reduce the likelihood that they burst into flame when they're subject to a match or they have too much heat, etc. The story begins back in the 1970s when there was great concern across the United States about fires that were set when people who were smoking fell asleep or otherwise dropped the cigarette into their furniture or into a pile of newspapers and started a fire. And the chemical companies saw a wonderful opportunity here, excuse me, to sell a chemical that they could produce to the tobacco industry to be put inside cigarettes to reduce their tendency to burn and to burst into flame. Pretty soon, however, it was discovered, as people became more critical of cigarettes, that these chemicals, whatever they may have done for reducing flames, were also producing cancer in people who smoked alongside of the tobacco itself. So a movement developed to stop smoking and to stop the use of flame retardant chemicals in cigarettes. This put the chemical companies into a bind. And since chemical companies are there to make a profit, they saw the problem of decreasing sales to the tobacco industry because it wasn't interested in these chemicals anymore and people were buying fewer cigarettes. They saw this as a problem to be solved by figuring out where else they could sell the flame retardant chemicals. So they discovered a new possibility. With heavy advertising, they persuaded people that you should have them in the pajamas and other clothing of children, so that they wouldn't have a fire that would hurt the children. It seemed to make sense, and it gave the chemical companies a new customer, the child clothing industry, to whom they could sell these chemicals. Now, they might have suspected that if the chemicals produced cancer through cigarette smoke, they might have a problem with clothing. If they thought about it, they sure didn't worry about it. But other people did, and there began to be a movement against putting these chemicals. Recently, states like California and Maine have introduced legislation to prevent the use not only of flame-retarding chemicals in clothing, but the other place that the chemical companies found to sell this stuff, the furniture industry. So now you can get a flame-retardant protected sofa or couch or chair. It turns out all of that is dangerous. What's the lesson here? Companies are interested in making money. And if they can't sell even the most dangerous chemical to one customer, they look for another customer. And when there began to be opposition, and this is what I found most interesting, opposition to the use of flame retardant chemicals because they were dangerous. Here's what happened. The chemical companies set up an effectively strange institution with a funny name. Citizens for Fire Safety. That's right, a front group. There's really no way to get around it. And its job was to go out there and say how wonderful flame-retardant chemicals are and how there are bad people out there that want to deprive our children of protection from fire. Well, reporters at the Chicago Tribune did some research. And according to Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, here's what he found. The Citizens for Fire Safety are really nothing other than a bunch of folks doing public relations for the chemical companies that have been behind this project for decades. Chemical companies seeking and making profits off of this, what should we call it? Project? Scam? Hustle? And Nicholas Kristof gives us the names, so I'm going to pass it on to you. Exxon, BASF, DuPont, and Dow Chemical. Your friends in the industry doing what capitalist enterprises do. Find ways to make money and hope nobody catches on, at least for a while, so they can make the bundle. Let me turn now to the first of our larger topics for discussion today before we get to the mid-program break. And here I'm responding, as I often do, to many of your emails, your comments, your suggestions. I'm going to put this issue as follows. Can we successfully, this is the question I get, can we successfully reduce the inequality of wealth and income that has become so extreme in the United States, more so than any other country now in the advanced industrial world? Can we do something about that by a mixture of rules and regulations that basically take some of the wealth accumulated by the rich and redistribute it to those who are poor or those who are in the middle and suffering? That's an old question in capitalist economic systems. So, for example, we have progressive taxation. We don't have much of it left in the United States, but we still have some, particularly the federal income tax. It takes a higher percentage of the income of wealthier people than it takes from the income of middle and lower income folks. So it is, in a sense, taking more from those who have more and redistributing it in the sense that it is paying for programs, let's assume for the moment, equally available to everybody. But has it really served to lower the inequality of wealth and income? The answer is an unqualified no. We have had a progressive income tax since 1910, but the inequality of wealth and income in the United States has gone back to what it was then throughout the whole intervening period. This progressive income tax didn't work to do what those who hoped it might do, didn't do what they hoped for, namely, it didn't do away with the extreme inequality of wealth and income. And the same is true with programs in the federal government like the food stamp program and subsidies for housing. There are literally hundreds of programs at the federal level, at the state level, laws, tax arrangements, regulations, whose goal and purpose is to redistribute the income, to take away some of what the wealthiest have and redistribute it to other folks. But the bottom line is, and here's the point I want to leave you with, it hasn't worked. And let's examine briefly why not. Well, the answer is the following. Wealthy people, big corporations, understanding that they were vulnerable to the effort to redistribute in a society where the mass of people have every interest in trying to redistribute wealth from the minority that are very rich to the vast majority that aren't. Those wealthy people and those large corporations understood their situation, and they went to work to undermine, to frustrate, and to evade the efforts to redistribute. So, for example, they attacked it as unfair. They attacked it as depriving them of the fruits of their hard work. They did what we are used to in our culture, make all the arguments, create all the obstacles so that redistribution either wouldn't be tried, or if tried, wouldn't work real well, would then get repealed, would be looked upon with bitterness and recrimination, and so forth. In other words, the effort to redistribute the unequal fruits of our economic system turned out not to work real well, to cause lots of contestation and bitterness, and to, in the end, be frustrated. This can lead some people, as it has, to think there oughtn't to be redistribution. Just let the system become more and more unequal because of the pain, the cost, the difficulty, and the ultimate failure of efforts to redistribute. But I would like to suggest an alternative way of looking at this. Here's the idea. We wouldn't have to have bitter struggles about redistribution if we didn't misdistribute income in the first place. In other words, if the income was distributed at the first point in a more equal way, we wouldn't need to have bureaucracies designed to redistribute. We wouldn't need to have the corruption that comes when the wealthy and the big corporations try to frustrate the goals of laws and regulations aimed at redistribution. We wouldn't have to have the government interfering, which so many Americans seem to not want. None of that would be necessary if we didn't distribute unfairly and unequally from the beginning. Now, how might that be arranged? Well, many of you will not be surprised by the suggestion I'm about to make if you listen to this program. Suppose we democratized enterprises. All I mean is, suppose we arranged that in every factory, office, and store across the United States, or for that matter, in any other country, the decision about how to use the profits of the enterprise, the net revenue, how much the enterprise brings in that is excess to the cost of doing whatever its business is. Suppose the decision on how to distribute that was democratically arrived at by all the workers together. Let me tell you what they would and wouldn't do. First, what they wouldn't do. They wouldn't do what we do in capitalism now, having a board of directors decide that the way to distribute the net revenues of their business is to give a few officials at the top millions of dollars, to give the shareholders millions or billions in dividends. They wouldn't do that. They would distribute the net revenue much more equally across all the workers who together produced that net revenue. They wouldn't unfairly and unequitably distribute it. Would they give some workers, for various reasons, more than others? Surely they would. Worker co-ops that work this way, for example, the famous one in Spain, the Mondragon Corporation, have a rule that the highest paid worker cannot get more than 8.5 times what the lowest paid worker does. The typical large American corporation, the CEO gets 200 to 300 times what the lowest paid worker does. That's why we have grotesque inequality. That's why we try and fail regularly to redistribute the unequally distributed net revenues of enterprises. Far better, far cheaper, and far less contentious would be if we, at the beginning, distributed the net revenues of every business in a much more equitable way. Then we wouldn't need redistribution, nor the bureaucracies that impose it, nor the contention over it, nor the evasive and often corrupt efforts of those at the top to prevent them from working. It's a better way to go. It's not the typical capitalist way, but that's just another critique of a system that isn't working and that is extremely costly and dangerous for social well-being, because it tries to redistribute what shouldn't have been distributed unfairly in the first place. We've reached the midpoint of our program. We're now going to take our short break, as we usually do. Music or announcements will follow. Please stay with us. I will be back in a short time. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. Talk to you again in a few moments.
against the wall, staring down an empty hall, deep down in a hollow log, coming home like a ladder bomb. Covers the storm that covered the night. Call a doctor, call a ghost, put a fire into your bones, sick a dog and all you know, cut it loose before you go. Covers the storm that covered the night.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I want to remind you, as I typically do, about the two websites where you can find out more of the sort of analysis we offer, as well as communicate your thoughts, criticisms, and questions to us. rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Please visit these websites, make use of them, and let us hear from you. And likewise, please remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. The next major discussion for today's program has to do with a question that comes in many forms, but that I want to face head on. It goes something like this. You're a critic of capitalism, and yet how do you deal with the response to your criticisms that says, look, China, which was once a poor country, is now using capitalism to develop a middle class, or at least a well-paid working class? And how do you respond to the remark that says that, after all, capitalism is what provided the workers in the United States and Western Europe and Japan the wherewithal to have their own home, their own car, their own television, and so on? I think that's a fair question, and I think the way to answer it is to talk about how capitalism works, because it'll put that question into context and allow me to answer it. The first thing is to understand that capitalism, whatever else you may think about it, has always been a society that develops unevenly. You all know that. If you go to any major city in the United States or elsewhere, you will be quickly shown by anyone who lives there where the rich people live and where the poor ones do. And you will quickly discover the enormous gulf that separates their lifestyles, their opportunities in life, the quality of their education, their diet, their clothing, you name it. So we are well aware that capitalism produces extraordinarily uneven outcomes. And I want to look at this historically because I think it can answer the question. Capitalism arose 200 or 300 years ago as a dominant system in Europe, in England to be precise, and spread from there to Western Europe and from there pretty much around the world. And in these first 200, 300 years up until around the 1970s, this capitalism was concentrated in three parts of the world: Western Europe, North America, and Japan. Those were the areas where the factories, the offices were concentrated. That's where the industrial jobs were concentrated. This had an interesting result. It brought huge numbers of people off of the countryside and into the cities to work in these industries, to work in capitalist enterprises. The conditions they found there typically weren't all that great. And so over time, they began to form unions, labor parties, socialist parties, efforts to improve the condition of employees in capitalist enterprises. That history is fairly well known. But here's the key point. While capitalism was concentrated in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, while capitalists there were confronting the rising demands of their workers for a decent life, those capitalists were able to accommodate those workers, not as much as the workers needed and wanted, but allowing them over time to get indeed a high standard of living, certainly high compared to with what working people had been able to get in the centuries before this. So yes, it's true. Capitalism was able to develop a good standard of living by historical standards for huge numbers of workers, not all by any means, but huge numbers of workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan. But capitalism developed unevenly. The good fortune of the workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, where capitalism was concentrated, has to be set against the disastrous decline of conditions in the Third World, as we used to call it, Asia, Africa, Latin America. A program or two ago, I gave you a report about a UNICEF program that wants to bring running toilets, indoor plumbing, to the 2.5 billion people who still don't have it, whose conditions of sanitation are worse than what they were 50 and 100 years ago because of urban crowding, because of the lack of the facilities keeping up with the conditions of where people live and how they live. In other words, the capitalism that did well for workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, that raised their wages, is the same capitalism that decimated huge swaths of the world's population in other parts of the world. And that has to be kept account of. And let me tell you why. Since the 1970s, a fundamental shift has occurred in world capitalism. And that shift can best be described as follows. Capitalists discovered that in the second half of the 20th century, there were several breakthroughs in global transportation and global communication. The jet airplane was the big breakthrough in transportation, and modern telecommunications, the internet, and all of that was the breakthrough in communication. Together, these things meant that any capitalist enterprise located in Western Europe, North America, or Japan could easily move its operations out of those areas where they'd been concentrated for 200 years and into Asia, Africa, and Latin America because they could get to and from those facilities quickly by jet aircraft. And they could monitor and control and observe their facilities in those countries instantaneously by means of modern telecommunications, the internet, email, etc. And these capitalist enterprises in Western Europe, North America, and Japan suddenly realized, why should we stay in those parts of the world where we have had to accommodate the demands of working people for higher wages and a better standard of living? Why should we stay there when we can move to the other parts of the world, the parts that were underdeveloped by capitalism over the last 200 years, where the wages are tiny? And I've given in the past the example I find most stark, that demonstration a month or so ago in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, where 200,000 workers marched through the streets of the capital demanding a minimum wage to be raised to $100 per month because the current rate is $38 per month. Enterprises can leave Chicago or St. Louis or Lille, France, or Bristol, England, or Dusseldorf, Germany, where they're paying many, many, many times what they can get away with paying in Bangladesh. As capitalist enterprises realized that they could make a fortune by closing their operations in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and moving them above all to China, but also to India, Brazil, and countless other countries in these parts of the world, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, they began to do so. And that movement has become a flood. And now I can answer the question. What is happening is that a working class, reasonably well paid, having to fight for everything it gets in China and India and Brazil, is slowly emerging there because the capitalists there want to make the enormous money they can make by the low wages there, and raising a very low wage a little bit all the time is a price they're willing to pay, because they'll still be getting away with much lower wages than they would have had to pay had they stayed in Western Europe, North America, or Japan. So yes, capitalism is bringing rising wages in Asia, Africa, and Latin America from a very low base, still leaving workers with much less than they would find even now in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. But now the other side again. As capitalism leaves the areas in which it began, Western Europe, North America, and Japan, the standard of living declines there. The standard of living of the workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan is being taken away from them. Their wages are going nowhere. The number of them suffering unemployment is higher than it has been historically. The benefits that go with their jobs are being diminished. The pensions, as we discussed at the beginning of today's program, are being cut. The message is everywhere. The standard of living is going down here. The same capitalism that was able to tolerate raising the standard of living has now made its decision. What's interesting for it, what will enhance its profits, is we're going elsewhere, and we're letting the places we used to be at dissolve. That's the tragedy of Detroit, of Cleveland, of Camden, New Jersey, and of countless other cities and towns in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan that are dying or already dead because they've been abandoned by the capitalist enterprises. So what's the critique of capitalism? It's the critique that says this is a highly irrational way of organizing the world. You decimate a huge portion in the first 200 years, then you abandon the places you built up for the next 100 or 200 years, rather than organizing a rational plan where we can all rise together, maybe at a slower rate than the best of us might have had, but without the world wars and the world conflict and the gross inequality and unfairness that our present system displays to us. We can't do better than this? Well, you know, I think that question is going to be answered, for example, by the working classes of Western Europe, North America, and Japan. They tolerated, they accepted, and some of them even celebrated capitalism over the last 200 years because it delivered to them rising wages. They didn't take a hard look at what it was doing in the rest of the world and what that danger might mean to them. But now they're learning that lesson. The same capitalism that raised their wages is the capitalism that is now decimating those wages, those benefits, those working conditions, and those social programs that they've counted on. Will the capitalism that was able to get support when it was raising the standards of living of workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, will it be able to hold on to their loyalty when it's offering them falling wages, lower public services, and a declining standard of living? No one knows the answer to that question, but it is going to be the question that defines the political economy and the political struggles of the next decades in Western Europe, North America, and Japan. It is something very important to understand. The history of the middle class in China as it emerges, and the middle class in the Western world as it dies. Both of them have to be evaluated when it comes to reaching a conclusion to answer this fundamental question. Can't we do better than capitalism? In the final portion of this program, I want to deal explicitly and directly with three questions among the many that you have sent in. And let me take a moment to thank you all for the extraordinary amount of support, encouragement, and questions and comments and criticisms that we get from you. It is an enormously gratifying response. It tells us that our program is being listened to. It tells us that our program is found to be valuable. It tells us that you're listening closely enough to catch us when we make a mistake, to probe, to ask questions that are important for many of you, and also for us to grapple with. We are grateful for all of that. And it is a wonderful way to acknowledge the validity of the project of which this program is a part. So thank you. First question. And this is a bit of a criticism of me. You don't stress enough, this questioner writes, the matter of free trade, the matter of the fact that the United States is now more intertwined with the rest of the world than it ever has been, in terms of the quantity of the goods it consumes that come from out of the country, the dependence of so many American industries on goods they sell outside the United States, and so on. And in particular, the person wants me to explore and to explain how foreign trade, particularly, affects the United States so that we understand what free trade has done and what we ought to be thinking about it. So let me try to do that. The first example, which the questioner also raised, has to do with efforts to stimulate the American economy. For example, if President Bush or President Obama cut taxes, and they both did, and if they both tried to stimulate the economy, put more money in people's pockets in a variety of ways, which also both presidents did, there's a problem in an economy that is as internationally focused as ours now is. And the best way to explain that problem is as follows. Suppose you put $1 million in a bunch of Americans' pockets through some government program. In the old days, when the United States was a pretty closed economy, when most of what we produced we consumed, most of what we consumed we ourselves produced, you could rely on the fact that the extra $1 million you put in people's pockets, they would spend on goods that they bought from other Americans, thereby giving those other Americans the income of that $1 million when they spent it. Those other Americans would in turn spend it on still other Americans. In other words, the money would stay in the United States, pass from hand to hand, generating expenditures and incomes for many, many people, and really boosting the American economy in that way. But of course, if we are an open economy, that is, we're open to international relationships, which we are more than ever, some of that is not going to happen. Part of the $1 million we stimulate the economy by putting into people's pockets is going to be spent on imported goods, the shirt and the socks that come from China, the appliances that come from Bangladesh, the equipment that comes from Brazil. And that means part of that money is going to be stimulating and creating incomes for workers in China and India and Brazil and so on, not in the United States. It's going to reduce the stimulative effect. And when we open ourselves through free trade to other parts of the world, one of the things we don't take into account, this questioner says, and I think that person has a point, we don't take into account the leakage, if you like. It's a term economists use, the way that international interactions siphon money out of the United States that would otherwise have stimulated our economy and actually served to stimulate them. Money put into the pocket of Americans who rushed down to Walmart and bought Chinese clothing was really good news for the Chinese economy as much, or in some cases more, than for the American. And the same is true if we stimulate enterprises by giving them access to cheap credit. They're not going to make investments because of the flood of inexpensive goods that come from other countries. The questioner makes the point again that free trade weakens the ability of the United States to manage its own economic affairs quietly, under the radar, but it's a real issue, and it is something that discussions of free trade have failed to acknowledge or recognize to the extent that this questioner thinks is important. And I think it's important enough to talk about it as well. Second question I want to respond to is also one that we frequently receive. This questioner put it as follows. Why do you keep talking, the questioner said to me, about reorganizing the workplace, democratizing the enterprise, workers' self-directed enterprises and all that, when the real issue is that work itself is disappearing with robotics, with automation, with all the new computer-controlled technologies, the need for human labor is retreating. And isn't that a much more important phenomena to be talking about than reorganizing the labor process when less of the world's people are going to be involved in labor altogether? My answer to this is, I believe there's a bit of a confusion here. No matter how much we are able to use robotics and computer-controlled technology, and I'm all in favor of it, and I think we need it, we're still going to have lots of work that people have to do. They have to supervise, repair, control, and adjust the robots. They have to supervise, observe, and control and adjust the computers. And there's a vast array of services, particularly that we provide to one another, which have to be hands-on, person-to-person. Labor is always going to be with us. If we can reduce the amount of labor, well and good. But that's not a substitute for asking the question, how do we organize labor? And let me be very concrete here. Suppose we cut the amount of labor we need to do through robots and everything else by, let's be bold, 30%, 50%. Well, the first question is, if we have to do 50% less labor, how are we going to organize that? Are we going to give 50% of the people no work to do while the other 50% keep right on working the way they did before? Or is everybody going to do 50% less than they did before? Those are two alternative ways of managing the labor that always, in the end, still has to be done. And when we get to the labor that still has to be done, how is that going to be organized? Are we going to have a handful of people telling everybody else what to do, cashing in on the profits that people who still work are producing? In other words, are we going to organize the work still to be done in the typical hierarchical top-down capitalist fashion? Or are we going to democratize that process? I think the two things have to be kept separate. Yes, we have to think about, deal with, and try to maximize the amount of release from labor that the human race can enjoy so that it can do more of the things that it wants to with less drudgery, less imposed demands for labor. But that's a separate matter from the key and equally important question, whatever the amount of labor that is left to be done, who's going to do it and how's it going to be organized? Is that going to be a democratic process or not? Is it going to cultivate equality of opportunity and life experience or not? Is it going to involve some people being in the driver's seat and everybody else doing what they're told or not? Those questions remain. And they are crucial not only to dealing with whatever work reductions we can achieve, but if you think about it, a democratic enterprise will have a different way of pursuing, funding, as well as accommodating the reduction in the total demand for labor in our societies. Last for today. A number of you have asked a very powerful and important question. If the global economy is in deep trouble and continues to be, and it is, and if governments around the world are basically imposing austerity on their people the way they are, for example, the attack on the pensions of public employees that we began today's program with, and if it is also true that the opposition among working people, trade unions, and so on, is growing and becoming more intense and bitter with Occupy Wall Street, with new political parties, and all that we've reported on for months. Is there a danger, these questions ask me, that governments will begin to resort to repressive measures to control and limit the opposition that their austerity policies are producing? And the answer is yes. And I'm going to give you an example and then the implication. Here's the example. The Spanish government last week in Madrid approved draft legislation for fines up to 30,000 euros. That'd be about $40,000 for the following offenses: burning the national flag, insulting the state, or causing serious disturbances outside parliament. That is a radical increase in the punishment the state proposes to mete out to people who do all of those things in opposition to the austerity policies in a country like Spain that has 27% unemployment and a population of young people that are emigrating to escape the awful conditions. Those who oppose are going to be subject to horrific fines. Let me issue a none too subtle commentary briefly, and then we close. This imposition of austerity is an attempt by the wealthy and the corporations of each country to shift the burden of this crisis onto the mass of people, to keep their extremely unequal wealth untouched, intact, to visit a crisis upon the mass of people and then make them pay for it. This is going to produce, it already has produced, record-breaking opposition. If they clamp down on this opposition rather than accommodate the demand of the majority, we are moving to conditions of real serious social conflict, if not civil war. This is a very serious issue, and we will return to it in future programs. Thank you for your attention. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. I look forward to being with you again next week.